Welcome to Discovery and Inspiration, a podcast from the National Humanities Center. I'm Robert Newman, President and Director of the Center, and your host for this episode. The influence that Nina Simone and Langston Hughes have had on American music, literature, and culture can hardly be overstated. However, the relationship between these two figures has received little to no attention from scholars to date, despite their long history of collaboration. Why has this connection between Nina Simone and Langston Hughes been so underexplored, and what can it tell us about the intersections between art and politics and the Black arts movement of the mid-20th century? Our guest today is Jason Miller, professor of English at North Carolina State University. His research focuses on 20th century African-American literature and culture. This year, as a fellow at the center, Jason is working on a project tentatively titled Backlash Blues, Nina Simone and Langston Hughes. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you.
First, if you would, Jason, tell us a little bit about how you got attracted to this project. What was the personal motivation?
I've been writing about Langston Hughes formally since 2001, and I was launching a book at Busboys and Poets in Washington, D.C., and I decided to tell a little flavor in the area about how Langston Hughes had worked at the hotel nearby, the Wardman Park Hotel, and the audience seemed to like it. So when I came to Raleigh to do this book event, I said, well, let's tell something about Langston Hughes and North Carolina history. And so I told the audience that day, I said, well, Langston Hughes often met a number of requests. And one day he was asked, would you be kind enough to write the liner notes for an album? And his response was, I'd be happy to, Nina. And the audience just gasped because Nina Simone is a legend in North Carolina. And the fact that Langston Hughes had supported her by writing and establishing her reputation really started this off. And I was stunned to find that in November 12th of 1960, Langston Hughes had written the premier review of Nina Simone's work at the very start of her career, really establishing her reputation.
This project clearly has international significance, but as you've said, North Carolina plays a really important role in the story. So can you elaborate a little bit about on this relationship between Nina Simone and Langston Hughes? You mentioned how it began to take shape, but how did that shape blossom, and how did the personal interactions get enhanced? How did the friendship develop from that point onward?
Well, you know, memory is sometimes as difficult as trying to match horseshoes to hoofprints. And so we really have had a hard time recognizing that a poet like Langston Hughes would have interacted with a musician like Nina Simone. It all started when Langston Hughes was a board member of the Newport Jazz Festival. So he personally invited Nina to perform in July of 1960. And at that moment, they met and started exchanging letters. And what became important at that moment was an answer to a central question I had. Looking at Langston Hughes' calendars, those ones that you flip on top of the desk in the 1960s from left to right, you'll find that he was spending more time with musicians than he was with writers in the 1960s. So at the very end of that famous jazz festival, Hughes had pitched an idea. He said, let's have a blues session to go along with the jazz musicians. So for 2.5 hours, he led a discussion and educational session in which he instructed Muddy Waters, Otis Spahn, and Johnny Lee Hooker on what type of blues he wanted them to play after telling stories about personal actions in anecdotes with the father of blues, W.C. Handy. Well, what was startling to find is that Nina Simone sat in the third row of the audience and watched that entire 2.5 hour session. So Nina would have seen Langston Hughes not as just a poet and a literary critic and a political figure, but as an expert on blues music. And from that moment, she realized that he was not only a mentor, but someone she could take musical insight from and cues from. And so that began a relationship where Hughes started sharing letters and poems, and then eventually song lyrics, and Nina started recording those song lyrics.
So is this sui generis? And if not, what does it tell us about the relationship between different genres of aesthetic expression for Black artists in the mid-20th century?
Well, I think as you know so well in your incredible advocacy for the humanities, we're at this point where we are so focused on interdisciplinarity for a very important reason. I think as Wallace Stegner said, that, you know, paradigms are like wet rawhide, and unfortunately when they dry, they strangle what they try to bind. And we think in terms of music, history, literature, psychology, maybe even sociology, But for these folks in the 1960s, this world of art was intermingled and working back and forth. And so we've had an old argument in literature. What do we do with song lyrics? And for those that were teaching this world in the 60s and 70s, well, songs aren't poetry. When Bob Dylan received the Nobel Prize for Literature, the Nobel Committee kind of weighed in and said, well, we don't think necessarily songs are poetry, but songs are a form of literature. And so when we get to this point, when they're working back and forth together, we have this notion that poetry and song overlap in Nina and Langston's worlds in unbelievable ways. Very briefly, Hughes wanted to publish popular music since 1949, and in fact, he had 60 songs recorded by numerous artists between 1949 and 1960. What do we do with Nina when she literally records poems by Paul Laurence Dunbar, When Melindy Sings, Warren Cooney, Images, and people like David Nelson's Today is a Killer? These aren't songs as poems. They're poems that are literally being performed in music. And Hughes himself had really set the tone for this in the 1920s when he started performing his blues poems with musicians in the background. And all the way through 1960, he'd performed live with great bassists like Charles Mingus, an incredible composer like Margaret Bonds. And so music and poetry go hand in hand. And I think they become at that wonderful intersection you set so well of politics, art, and culture overlapping. And the relationship really epitomizes that.
So the mentorship that Langston Hughes offered Nina Simone, and of course, Nina Simone is the high priestess of soul, involves not just guidance related to forms of self-presentation or artistic creation, but also provides insight into their respective political commitments, as you've already mentioned. But let's delve into that a little bit more. So the Backlash Blues, the source of your project's title, for example, might help us to understand more about Hughes' perspective on events like the Vietnam War during that time. Could you speak about the ways that Hughes and Simone articulated some of these commitments through songwriting and performance?
The Backlash Blues is an amazing story that speaks to this collaboration and enunciation of resistance. And Nina Simone really refined strategies that Langston Hughes pioneered during the Harlem Renaissance to create the soundtrack to the Civil Rights Movement and inaugurate the birth of Black Power. What's fascinating about the Backlash Blues is the term itself, the white backlash, had come to us in 1964. It's from an old English concept of a belt breaking on a factory wheel and the belt hitting people and hurting them. The white backlash was, of course, what occurred after people started gaining power and control. So in October of 1966, there are now white backlash candidates who are running on entire platforms of speaking out against Blacks getting power in America. And when Hughes pens this poem in October of 66, he's thinking about an upcoming election in which a number of candidates are running on this concept. Nina gravitates towards this song because she realizes it speaks to a larger issue beyond politics. It's talking about housing. It's talking about America overstepping in the Vietnam War. And eventually, it's seeing kind of an internationalism at work, that what happens one day when yellow, black, brown, and beige people, as Hughes writes in the poem, unite against kind of these controls of America. And so one of the leading backlash candidates of that year was a B-list actor who decided to run for governor in California. And Ronald Reagan ran on a white backlash platform. And this song, as they move back and forth, can be traced as a way in which Nina really carried Hughes's message and regarded him at the avant-garde of kind of the Black Power movement and then what would be called the Black Arts movement. And so she sings this song from November 22nd, 1966, all the way up to 1976 at virtually every single concert she performs, whether she has 12 songs on her set list or 6 songs. And the audience reaction is one that unites the two in a movement that says, this is something we're going to stand against. This is a resistance movement against housing, against the Vietnam War, and against this notion of whites not understanding the power of Black music and Black art.
So the work that you've been pursuing at the center builds on digital work that you found, that you've had to assemble, and of course, looking at the shared recordings of both Simone and Hughes in various archives. Tell us a little bit about the kind of detective work that you've had to do in order to track down some of these rare original recordings, and what the experience of developing a book project in conjunction with a major digital humanities venture has been like.
The Humanities Center has been instrumental in aiding my research in unbelievable ways. And so much of this information is actually recorded on vinyl and the liner notes, and you even have to sometimes look at the actual artwork of the original albums. So, for instance, when we have a song that Simone made famous called Mississippi Goddamn, we have to track what that actually sounded like culturally. What is going on and what is happening? And so there's actually a single that was released of that song in which the word goddamn couldn't be on the radio. And so it had to be bleeped out. And that has been known but never really heard or talked about. And so I've actually, with the center's incredible help, been able to track down the original single of that and listen to what that really would have sounded like. And you get a sense that Simone's impact was not only to stand against but also kind of reinterpret things for folks. More interestingly, becomes the artwork that accompanied Simone's albums. This notion of her is linked to her fashion and can be seen when she switches over. Simone recorded on 4 record albums. She started on Bethlehem, then went to Colpix, then was on Philips, and eventually RCA. The switch from Philips to RCA is fascinating. RCA Records was known for highlighting Africanness in their artists. When Miriam Makeba appeared, she appeared in very elaborate garb, incredible headdress, costume, giant earrings. When Nina Simone switches over from Philips to RCA, all of a sudden her image gets a makeover, and she has this startling look, and it takes place immediately in 1967. And so this notion of her becoming the high priestess of soul begins with Langston Hughes pitching her that she sing a song about putting a spell on people. The name of her autobiography is I Put a Spell on You after that famous song. But then it gets caught up in this intricacy between these two record labels where Philips has one record they want to release right before Nina switches to RCA. And so they think of a way of outdoing RCA, and they put this elaborate drawing of Nina on the cover. They make up this title, The High Priestess of Soul, and all of a sudden they've tried to outdo RCA at their own game. RCA's reaction is fascinating. Their first album, they take a picture of the real Nina Simone, like the drawing that Philips has, as if to say, we've got the real thing. All you can do is produce the artwork. And so this kind of cultural history shapes the way Nina is being received, reminds us what group she was standing for, and really points to this notion of how popular her image actually was. And it's only by this incredible ephemera of record albums in their original form that you can really start to piece the whole story together about what reputation Nina Simone eventually earned.
Tell us a bit more about any surprises you found in doing archival research, you know, just discoveries that you had no idea were going to happen when you went into the archives and started to peruse things.
Oh, there's so many. I'll pick one very quickly. So when I came into the project, the Newport Jazz Festival in 1960 ended when support for the blues event that Hughes was leading was so astronomical that whites rioted when they couldn't get tickets and the festival had to be closed early. I mean, think about it. 20,000 people had never had the chance to hear blues music before without sneaking into clubs in inner cities. And so at the end of that session, Langston Hughes takes out a Western Union telegram and he writes out song lyrics for what's called Goodbye Newport Blues. All the research that I'd encountered before I came to the center said Muddy Waters ended up singing this song. Well, I put on the Bose headphones when I was here a few months ago, and I'm like, that's not Muddy Waters' voice. That's someone else. And I realized quickly that it was Muddy Waters' pianist, Otis Spahn. So the session looked like this. Right at the end, Langston Hughes snuck a very famous performer named Little Jimmy Rushing up on stage. He was known as Little Jimmy Rushing because he's Mr. 5x5. He was 5 feet tall and 5 feet wide, and so it was a joke. He goes up on stage, and he starts riffing on lyrics, and he said, if anybody tells you who put me here, tell them it was Little Jimmy Langston that put me here, and he nods off to Hughes, who's over off side stage. But most importantly, at the very end, I realized it was Muddy Waters' pianist that sang the final song, Goodbye Newport Blues. And I walked around, and I booked the notes, and I looked at my timeline, and finally it clicked. Hughes had written the song on the Western Union Telegram. Why couldn't Muddy Waters sing it? He'd never learned to read. And so it was Otis Spahn who had to put the lyrics up on the piano, play through it, and go through it. And so we've corrected the record on that particular front in that regard. The other one is really startling as well. It has to do with that song Backlash Blues. When Hughes gave the lyrics to Simone, I've been tracking the drafts over and over again, and they're kind of long and running on, and the final version is very short and truncated, and I finally realized that the final version was a result of Nina saying, I can't sing the lyrics you just gave me, but if we compress them in this way, I can sing this version. And so Nina literally composed the final verses of Backlash Blues in collaboration with Langston because they were the way she could sing them. And that's the thing she would do with any lyrics she inherited in the studio. The same thing she did with Bessie Smith's song, I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl. And one of the things that Nina did really well is, like so many artists, unfortunately, she was robbed of her royalties in the contract she signed. But she took a stand from day one. When she signed her first contract, she said, I will make all final choices on the actual albums and songs. And so she had complete control over what she sang and made those choices. So that was a really startling find as well. It's the kind of thing you hope to get to and are kind of surprised when it actually happens.
So finally, tell us a little bit about your hopes for the impact of this project. So not just for your fellow historians, but also why should our general audience care that you're doing this project? How are you advancing knowledge through this project?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is about 8 years ago, I made a major shift in my personal research. I decided that I want my research to be visible, relevant, and accessible. And the visibility for me meant people should see it and hear about it that aren't necessarily associated with institutions and academies. And then the relevance is, once they hear about it and see it, it should have something to do with their daily lives or what's happening in the zeitgeist of our moment. And then the final element is, once they are interested enough and see something that's relevant, it should be accessible. It shouldn't have the language of the dialogic, the diacritic. It shouldn't be talking about things like anaphora and epistrophe consistently. So this project is visible in that it touches on a cultural icon like Nina Simone and catches people's attention. It's relevant because the modes of resistance she demonstrated and showed are ones that artists still need to be aware of today. What is so important about documenting the moment when it happens? What is so important about speaking to a general audience and not just to specialists? And what is so important about the role of performance when you can sneak in anecdotes and representation on a stage when people don't think they've come for something political? And then finally, it's accessible because the music that Simone and Hughes co-created comes to us in these particular ways. At this particular moment, this project is seeking to do something that neither of my other works have tried to do, and that is give us a model for intergenerational collaborative resistance. We have a number of groups of peers that have found their way to stand up for their rights and make seismic change. We have great examples of people in Nashville that will point to predecessors like John Lewis, Diane Nash, and C.T. Vivian pushing them to now take stands on their own in legislatures. But we don't have examples of older folks like Hughes working with younger folks and Simone on a daily basis, being something other than mentors. And this intergenerational aspect, to me, makes this project really, really potent because we can see that Simone had all kinds of peers she worked with, like Lorraine Hansberry and James Baldwin, but only Hughes was a person that pushed her actual music to be political. Many other figures found they could be popular, like Harry Belafonte, and then use their clout to make political change. So Simone made the choice that Hughes progressed, and that was this notion of the art itself will be the statement. And I think more and more today, as we think of musicians and artists, I think we can see this kind of work that doesn't just have to go horizontally, but can go vertically. And I think Simone and Hughes, in many ways, give us a vertical moment in our horizontal lives.
Great answer. So thank you, Professor Jason Miller, and thank you to everyone who has joined us for this discussion. I'm Robert Newman. Please tune into the next episode of Discovery and Inspiration from the National Humanities Center.